Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you all with us here. Still, that, of course, is the great Johnny Mathis, who was born on this day in 1935 in Gilmer, Texas, singing Venus, one of the greatest singers of all time. And this remained, that particular song remained on the charts for 9 years, Johnny Mathis. So as we do our music interludes on this day in history, we'll hear more of that as the show goes on. We are now joined in by three people to wrestle with something that has kind of taken, especially the social media and community conversations, by storm. Alessandra Stanley, who is the New York Times TV and film critic, whose work I've read over the years, and I've really kind of appreciated some of her in-depth looking at issues around film and TV. But this particular piece that she wrote about the new TV series, How to Get Away with Murder, and her kind of perspective on Shonda Rhimes, who has kind of changed the nature of the portrayal of black women on television with her work, who helped create this series, the executive producer of this series. When she wrote about this, she wrote about black angry women and talked about this is how Shonda should be remembered and who she is. And there was more that we'll get into. But it causes a huge firestorm of response. And so we thought it was worth a deep discussion about the imagery that takes place in our society, what that imagery means, and what this particular thing, and why it set off this debate, and what this debate means now in this year, 2014. We are joined in studio by Dr. Lisa N. Williams, who's Director of Equity and Cultural Proficiency for the Baltimore County Public Schools. She's a member of the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a project of Fusion Partnerships. Her forthcoming book is in When Treating All Kids the Same,
Is the real problem.
Is the real problem. Sorry, I wrote this down quickly. And we're looking forward to having her on when she talks about that book here in studio. Dr. Kay Whitehead is back with us, Assistant Professor of Communication and Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and African-American Studies at Loyola University, author of Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, which received the Letitia Woods Brown Award for the best edited book in African American history from the Association of Black Women Historians. She just received that in Memphis just yesterday.
Yes, thank you so much.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And Daniel McLean joins us, contributing writer to TheNation.com, where she reports on gender issues, and a fellow at The Nation, student. Daniel McLean, good to have you with us as well.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@steinershow.org. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. As we look at this question of the imagery of black women in our media, in our world, in our nation, and what the beauty ideal is in America, and I think that there's kind of a really social intellectual thing that Daniel McLean that fueled this response to Alessandra Stanley, but it's more than an intellectual response. It's something that really I think it's just forcing us to have a discussion that we need to have. Dana McLean?
I think that you're right. I think, you know, it's interesting. September seems to have been a month where many of these issues were brought to the fore. We saw, obviously, Alessandra Stanley's piece about Shonda Rhimes. There was a conversation about the young woman, the actress in Los Angeles, who was Danielle Watts, who was approached by a police officer because she was suspected to be having sex with her partner in the car.
Oh, right.
And, you know, was then handcuffed and detained because the assumption was that she was a prostitute. And, of course, different facts have come to light since that kind of complicate that story. But there was also the situation with Olivia Spencer, you know, actually a co-star of Viola Davis in The Help, who is starring in a new show on Fox News. And there were ads promoting the show where the words scary bitch were, you know, placed next to her as kind of a description of her character. And organizers in Los Angeles complained, and those ads were removed from the sides of buses throughout Los Angeles County. But yeah, I mean, it's been a month where we've seen a number of black women in the spotlight kind of, characterized in ways that are quite problematic. And I think it's created a conversation. You mentioned social media. I think Twitter, and particularly black women on Twitter, have really led the conversation, kind of calling out these moments and questioning when, you know, calling out people like Alessandra Stanley, who has this platform at the New York Times, and putting the kind of pressure on her that's resulted in both the public editor and eventually the executive editor Dean Baquette having to weigh in and kind of, you know, acknowledge that there were problems with Alessandra Stanley's report. So it's been an intense month, and I think we're just, you know, at a point where we're pointing out the problems, and I think what's next are, you know, what are some of the solutions that we can arrive at?
You know, to pick up on that before we get to the idea of solutions and where we are and what this effect is on society. One of the things that struck me also, Lisa Williams, was that when I read this and when Viola Davis is called less than classically beautiful in the piece, you know, I mean, here's my guess and my bet. My bet is that Alessandra Stanley, who I've never met, though I know people in Times who work through her, friends of mine who know her, say she's a nice woman, intense writer, bright woman, and probably doesn't think of herself as a racist at all.
Right.
And to me, it is the... I don't want to use the word unconscious assumptions because that puts it aside too much, but it is something that lurks in the consciousness and you don't even know it's there. You're not thinking about this. I mean, I'm writing these lines. I don't think these lines are derogatory. I think they describe something that I think, but why do we think that way? I mean, there's a complexity here to this, I think, that's why this is so important.
Well, part of the problem I would submit is that we have, as black women, largely been left out of the larger narratives about what is beautiful, what is interesting, what is intellectual. And so when Chandra Rhimes creates characters that are complex,
right,
that have emotional depth, and they don't fit the stereotype of video girl or mammy, then what is the stereotype that is left? What do we call intellectual, ambitious, bright, beautiful, sassy black women? What do we call them? And because there is no good language, we fall back into these caricatures that are very easy for us to grapple onto because those are the ones that have been out there for public consumption that are readily available for readers who in large part are crashing into diverse people, meaning you run into folks of color at the market or maybe at the movies, but you're not necessarily socializing with them. You don't. You may live in the same neighborhoods, but you're not having dinner at one another's homes. So the complexity that really represents or characterizes the range of the ways that we as black women show up in our society, we have not given the larger population access to. So the stereotypes become very easy to take hold to.
Well, I just want to add to that and agree with both the guests thus far. Danny had said that it has been a very intense month in our understanding and in our deconstruction of how black women are talked about in the media. I would expand that and say it's really, when you look at the long arm of history, it's always been very complicated, the ways in which we describe and accept and understand black women, as well as deciding what is beautiful and what is not. That particular line, that's one of the lines that struck me the most, along with "the help is now on top." There are quite a few lines from that New York Times piece that are very problematic. I wondered when I read through it, it wasn't just the writer. I wondered who's also taking a look at these pieces before they make it to the newspaper, because some of her off-the-cuff remarks that might have been cheeky in her head, once they made their way onto to the black and white of the paper, somebody should have caught it before it got there. And I think that some of the characters that she draws up, she talks about Florida from Good Times. Mm-hmm. At the time that Florida character was very popular, she was seen as a very strong black female character. She was someone who was holding the family together. When her husband died, she rose to that occasion and started working and bringing money into the home. In fact, when she left the show for a short period of time, one of the reasons they brought Florida back onto the show is that people were calling for the black mother to come back because she was that glue that held the family together. So seeing that and kind of dismissing and saying, well, we're just kind of getting to this mm-hmm. era of strong black women, I think that is incorrect, particularly on television. I also did not like the way that she called the Clara Huxtable character benign, as if the fact that she was, for a number of people and a number of the people in the audience, that she was comfortable in terms of being a successful, what they call stereotypically beautiful black woman who they did not seem to be a threat. I challenge her to go back and watch some of the shows when people would threaten her children, when people would assume that she didn't know what she was talking about. The Claire Huxtable that I know who became what we consider to be an angry black woman, which I think that phrase itself is very, very complicated because it gets into the ways in which we move our body, the ways in which our faces has to be handled. The anger becomes this tool that we use to kind of eviscerate conversations, but anger in the hands of, say, a white male becomes a weapon that he can then use to get change happening on the ground. Is who has this tool and who decides whether the tool is actually being used to make change or tool that's a weapon when you want to dismiss the person who has it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, Danny, I was thinking about this as I was listening to Kay that you know, that we've seen this brought this long history of characters on television, of black women characters on television, and what Kay described is really interesting. I think that. People may disagree with some of the characterizations, but not like all the previous characters that came on television. And I think that maybe weren't fully appreciated. But these new characters that are coming up, I think that what it strikes is, whether it's in Scandal or whether it's in this particular show, is that we're being confronted with characters who are smart and in charge. Not, you know, I think that is the delineation and difference mm-hmm. here. Is it smart, in charge women who are making decisions, being tough, and being bright, and being sexy all at the same time. And that's, I think, a relatively new role for black women in TV and film mm-hmm. and media in general.
I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right. And I think that's why, you know, if you're on Twitter on a Thursday night, you know, when the Scandal, How to Get Away with Murder, you know, lineup starts, it's like this moment, this celebratory moment where so many black women who are, you know, some of the most incisive, thoughtful, funny voices on Twitter, you know, kind of come into community together to kind of rejoice that these characters are there on screen in a way that they haven't been in the past, because in so many ways we can identify with those characters because they're us. I think that, yeah, and I think, you know, the angry black woman phrase that Alessandra Stanley used, it just struck me as so tone deaf. It struck me as if she, you know, has kind of been lulled into this belief that we are in some kind of post-racial society, so that she can use this phrase that is actually still quite charged. You know, in her responses to all the criticism, she seemed to almost, you know, not understand what all the fuss was about, because clearly we're past a moment where that phrase could actually be considered offensive to anyone. So it struck me as so kind of out of tune and out of touch with, you know, the realities and the kind of ways in which black women are still mischaracterized and marginalized in so many ways. She seemed to think that, oh no, we're at a blank slate. I can kind of say whatever I want. I also think there's a way in which, you know, Shonda Rhimes, she talked about Kerry Washington's character, Viola Davis's character, as if Shonda Rhimes, you know, is writing herself into these characters. You know, that they're really some kind of on-screen manifestations of Shonda Rhimes, and that's how she was able to say, you know, these characters are angry black women, and Shonda Rhimes herself is an angry black woman, without also looking at the white women and Asian women. You know, the thinking of the two of the main characters on Grey's Anatomy, who are also incredibly, you know, powerful, thoughtful women who sometimes get angry and who obviously have a very strong point of view. It was as if Alessandra Stanley couldn't understand that here's, you know, that Shonda Rhimes is a writer and a creative person who is using her imagination, not just writing from her own life, to create complex characters across lines of race and ethnicity. I think you're right. I think we're at this moment where people can't quite, as another guest pointed out, because they're not experiencing complex, fully human black women in their daily lives, some people don't know what to make of it when they see it on television, because it seems so out of touch with the kind of, you know, monochrome, homogenous social lives that they inhabit.
I think, and what's interesting here also, and before we go to break here, is to kind of begin to wrestle with some of these issues in public for the first time. Mm-hmm. Not the first time, but yeah. But the larger public is what I mean to say. I mean, because women, all women, when they are in the media or in power, are seen as using the B word, or seen as being evil and domineering if they are in charge. Mm-hmm. But the black angry woman thing is such kind of a large stereotype in this country, mm-hmm. about black women who are either smart or in charge of an agency or in charge of a business, mm-hmm. at the top of whatever game they're in, and have people under them who may be men, women, black, white, and every other thing. And so we have this image and these all the video clips that are all over YouTube about angry black women standing up and hitting somebody or screaming at somebody in a store.
They're not always connected to power.
No, they're not, right. They're not always connected to power. Right. And so that becomes, it's a very complex stereotype.
Well, and here's the thing. I think we should not underestimate the power of social media in this conversation. Namely because we get to, as black women, start to define ourselves and push back on some of these ideas about how we're being characterized that fall in those stereotypic lines. And if, again, there hasn't been conversation, if there hasn't been discourse, and the larger images of these really powerful black women are being proffered by the larger white society that doesn't necessarily have the nuanced understanding of how anger sometimes is anger, sometimes is hurt, sometimes is passion, sometimes is pain, without access to social media where black women can speak into that experience and offer a different perspective. While it may be true that we've had many black characters who are female who we have seen in the community as strong,
right.
as more than
right.
moms,
right.
The larger society hasn't actually taken that away from what's been out in the public.
And that's why this is an interesting cusp we're on now. And I think I want to explore some of the – we'll take a break here, but I want to kind of – I just read a piece earlier last night called The Beauty Ideal, The Effects of European Standards of Beauty on Black Women, and kind of the root of all this, and looking at the root of this, but also then where does this conversation go? Because I think one of the things that Lisa just touched on is that that social media has given – people a voice who never had a voice before, that are now being the larger media has to then pick up and listen to and wrestle with at some level. So we'll come back and talk about those two things when we take this break. We'll be right back.
Half the girl I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday.
Welcome back. That's the great Frankie Lyman, of course, that left us. And we celebrate his life on this day in history. And before we went to break, I'm not a delinquent, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. Before that, we went out with Sissy Houston and yesterday. So we come back to our discussion here with our guests. Please join us at 410-319-8888. We want to hear your thoughts on this. And write to us here at talk@sanishow.org. 410-319-8888. We're here with Dr. Lisa Ann Williams, who is a director of equity and culture proficiency in Baltimore County Schools and a member of the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a project of the Fusion Partnerships. Danny McClain, contributing writer to TheNation.com, where she reports on gender issues, a fellow at The Nation Institute. And Dr. Kay Whitehead, assistant professor of communication and affiliate assistant professor of African-American studies at Loyola University, 410-319-8888. Please join us here. Let's pick up where we left off. I want to pick up where we left off that the listeners did not hear. And I don't know if, Danny, you heard the conversation going on in the studio. You may have.
Cause I couldn't.
Because the mics are open. But let's
no,
talk.
I didn't hear, unfortunately.
Okay, well, the argument went back and forth about what I said earlier about Twitter and what was said about Twitter, opening up this, forcing a dialogue in the New York Times, which forces a national conversation. And Kay, I'll let her speak for herself, but Kay was arguing back that this conversation has been going on for a long time by black women all over the country, not being paid attention to is what Lisa Williams is saying. But I think that's changed because of the way media works now. forcing the New York Times, because of the popular uprising on Twitter, to address something they would never have addressed publicly otherwise?
Well, I use Twitter a lot. I'm a big Twitter. I teach communication. I teach my students about the power of Twitter. What I try to help them to understand, because they sometimes think it is because of Twitter that people have voices. I argue that people have always had voices. These conversations have always happened. What Twitter has done as a tool is that it's allowed all of these private conversations happening in communities to now join together. So I'm having a larger conversation that then forces, for example, the New York Times to issue an apology, for them to rethink their policy. Or you look at what used to be the power of Black Twitter. I mean, we now talk about the fact it goes across, you know, racial and ethnic lines, but that people are joining together and calling for change to happen. I just wanted to make sure that people are aware that these conversations have been happening. They have been marginalized, yes, to a number, to a very large extent, but the conversations have been happening. We've been wrestling with this ideal image of what it means to be beautiful long before we started dealing with it on with Shonda Rhimes and these television shows. I mean, that European standard of beauty has been passed down historically for hundreds of years of what do we call and what do we label and what do we name Black women. And the closer you are to looking European in terms of having a straighter nose, in terms of having finer or thinner hair, to having lighter skin, that is what is considered to be beautiful. If you look at all of the list of beautiful people that they've had in People magazine, and you look at the women they choose to put on that list, I'm talking about women of color who are on that list, the standard of beauty has always been those that tend to look more European in their features. We notice, we go back to American enslavement. This goes back historically. I don't think the root is just the European standard of beauty. We go back to the root of American enslavement and how Black women were treated at that time and how they were separated at that time.
Lisa?
So I would absolutely agree. I think that the we, though, is what we need to be really clear about who's been having what kinds of conversations. Mm-hmm. Because within the Black community, you know, it is not something that would be seen as unusual for a group of Black women to sit around and talk about how images are bandied about and how one is received differently depending on hair texture, depending on body shape, et cetera, et cetera. So within the community, there has certainly been a recognition that the way one shows up in larger society will get you a response that may or may not be related to you know, what your mission is in this world. But the larger piece that has struck me in conversations that I've had about race is the degree to which the conversations that I have as a Black woman within the Black community are substantively different than the level of awareness, the kinds of conversations, the kinds of issues that average white people are having on a regular basis. So in many instances, it really is an illuminating experience when you offer the perspective about, you know, being treated differently when your hair is straight versus when it is natural, or when you have your face made up a certain way versus when you have no makeup on at all. To share some of that with my white colleagues and friends, they oftentimes give me a very quizzical look as though this were the first time that they've had these kinds of conversations.
Because it is. Because it is.
And I just want to, you know, it's been said, but this is such an important point. Twitter, the Alessandra Stanley piece, I think it was posted online late on a Thursday night or maybe early on a Friday morning.
Right.
Yep.
Immediately, you know, people on Twitter were like, what is this mess?
Yep.
You know, I think there was a hashtag agreed upon. I can't exactly remember what it was. Shonda Rhimes herself responded to the piece via Twitter. In a very classy kind of, you know, way that said, like, I barely have time to be paying attention to this, but, you know, this
right.
I'm offended. And, you know, the piece didn't even run in the paper until Sunday. But you know, on Friday, when it first went online, yeah. Color of Change, which is an online advocacy campaign, I'm sorry, online advocacy organization, civil rights organization, launched a campaign calling on the New York Times to apologize. There were already, you know, a dozen think pieces at least posted on Friday to sites like, I think, Jezebel. I think there was a great piece that ran in The Guardian. And by Monday, Margaret Sullivan, the public editor at the New York Times, had responded. And what I thought was fascinating was if you looked at her post, there were like two or three updates throughout the day, which to me signals that newsroom is buzzing. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some conversations happening in that newsroom, you know, between Alessandra Stanley, her editor, the public editor. That's not something, I just agree with the guests who have said, of course, yeah, obviously, we've been having these conversations internally for quite mm-hmm. a while, but the ability to make an institution respond within days, that's mm-hmm. new, and I think that that's very much related to the power of digital media.
And I think that's important in the shows we're talking about that Shonda Rhimes does. I mean, she is brilliant in the work that she does. She's like, to me, I can think of a number of people, you know, David Chase, David Simon, a bunch of others, Lena Dunham, who kind of really are radical on the edge TV creators who do things that other people have not done and broken new ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's interesting because her characters, it's also interesting, the other part of this is her characters she puts out there in the pieces I've seen, she doesn't necessarily deal with race in her programs.
No. Right.
Right? She's putting out black characters of a certain class and character mm-hmm. that it's not post-racial, mm-hmm. but right. it doesn't deal with race. Right. And I think that's interesting that this is it exploded in that context,
right.
you know. And that to me, because she's also playing this TV New York Hollywood game of how you get things on TV,
right.
Mm-hmm. And get these characters on, which is not talking specifically about race. It's not even a Bill Cosby show. It's something very
right.
different.
Right.
And so that's the complexity of that as yep. well in terms of media I find fascinating.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because we live race. You know, that's the one thing we all have in this country is race. Mm-hmm. And so we might not ever call Olivia Pope black, but you see her as black. And so when these episodes come on that are a bit risque, where she's having an affair with a white man who is married, or she is then involved with the friend of the married white man, and she has this dad who looks very stereotypically patriarchal, and we, you know, retreat into our communities and we have conversations about what we are seeing, we may never use the words black or white, but the way that we understand race will show up in those discourses. Hence, the easiest label to apply to these characters who are showing up very strong-willed, very assertive, mm-hmm. very aggressive. Oh, and by the way, in black female skin is the angry black woman. That is our language.
I think what I've always liked about Shonda Rhimes, I was a fan of Grey's Anatomy, is I like the
right.
way she plays around a lot with interracial relationships without calling attention to race, whether it's
right.
the Asian female character with the African-American male character, that she plays around with all of these lines, because when we exist within this space, sometimes we're just living out our lives as doctors. So it's interesting the ways that she introduced race through Grey's Anatomy, quite a few shows where they dealt with it, but that was not the prevalent central issue. They were just doctors dealing with all the things they deal with. And I find that to be the same with Scandal. But it's interesting when you look at Olivia Pope's family on Scandal, that the images and the way she kind of creates these characters, her family characters, does show up quite a lot in the black community, which I think is a very interesting play.
What were you about to say, Danny? I heard you about to say something.
No, I was just agreeing wholeheartedly with your guest comment. I mean, I think, you know, I think that the power of what Shonda Rhimes is doing, you know, I think she is one of the few people who is taking seriously race-neutral casting. Right, where, you know, I've read things that she's written where she's looking for actors who embody the spirit of the character that she's written. She doesn't go into casting with the idea that this is a black character or this is a white character, this is an Asian character. And we don't see that on television. I mean, who else is doing that? And mm-hmm. so she's you know, created a container for these kinds of, you know, interesting dynamics to play out. I was just agreeing with your previous guest.
So, folks, what do you think of 410-319-8888? This is, I think, a really important discussion for America to have, and I think that I'd like to know how you're having it, what you're thinking about it, what your thoughts are when you've been watching this on Twitter, social media, wherever you've been following it. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. 410-319-8888. Because I was thinking about what you said earlier, Lisa, in my response to you, and I think this is really, it's important. And you said you have these conversations at work with white colleagues and the actors if they've never heard it before. And I said my response was, because they haven't.
I'm not confused about that, by the way.
but I think that that's why things like this that are getting set up, I think, mm-hmm. in America right now are really important because people are wrestling with and seeing things they never were forced to deal with before.
Sure.
You know, I mean, because you could assume certain things. You know, I heard people say things like to me, someone said to me, well, I don't think Kerry Washington is very beautiful. Somebody was white. I went, okay, well, you don't have to, but I mean, the idea that we are forcing a conversation and maybe an unconscious conversation, especially on younger people, mm-hmm. about conceptions of beauty and who's beautiful, what's going on. I think that's mm-hmm. what this is creating that's so important about changing the nature of society.
I mean, so our desire to be post-racial, our desire to be colorblind, all of these larger philosophical aspirations are so problematic in the daily living. Right. Because part of what is happening, whether we're having these conversations or not, is that we're making assignments. And the unfortunate part is that when those assignments start to come to the fore, mm-hmm. the ones that are associated with black are negative and those that are associated with white are often positive. And so if we think that, you know, being colorblind or if we think that not just talking about the complexity of a character through a cultural lens is going to move our society forward, I would just ask that we take a look at our recent responses to things that have happened around the country that have had elements of race show up and ask yourself the question, how far is that really getting us in situations where we really need to be able to effectively communicate one with another about what's in the best interest of our society as a whole?
I don't think that we will ever be post-racial until we take seriously the issue of talking about race at the deepest roots. I get offended when people tell me they don't see race. I'm like, well, how do you not see race? There's this history that's going along in our country that you're socializing as you come through the school system, so you can't say that you were blind to race. Instead, what you're saying is you don't see deficit in race. So let's get to what that means, because you do see my race when I walk into the room. That one line from the Stanley article where she talks about Viola Davis at 49, sexual, even sexy, and that she's less classically beautiful, older, dark skin. Even though that was a very controversial line and people really took to that, that was a line that really struck me. Because when you think about leading ladies, when you think about what's accepted as beautiful, you think younger. You think shaped a certain way. You think skin color a certain way. It's still what is most prevalent. So casting Viola Davis does go against all of those stereotypes, whether you're dealing with age, because here she is. That is, she is an older woman who has this lead. She's still sexy, and they have shaped her. And I'm talking about shaped her in terms of writing that character out this way. That here's a woman who's not 30, who's not 25, who's not, you know, 32. She's a 49-year-old woman, and she is embracing what it means to be, mm-hmm. you know, kind of, the, you know, 49 is a new 39, whatever that means. Right. Even her skin color, even her hair, all of that is changing the way that people hopefully are beginning to think about beauty. So maybe, you know, I don't think Stanley got it all wrong. I think that that does challenge what we have always seen as what is beautiful without talking about it. That Viola Davis gives us a different image of what it means to be beautiful, sexy, as an older, very accomplished woman.
Well, and part of accelerating that progression is wrapping language around it.
Right.
Because I love the fact that she shows up the way that she does. And she's bad. I mean, to use the vernacular from the community, she's bad. And let's just talk about how different this is than all of these other images that have been fed to you about what it means to be powerful, sexy, mm-hmm. and accomplished.
Absolutely. Danny?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciated the earlier point about the importance of connecting some of these conversations about how black women show up in the media to, you know, events, right? What's actually happening across the country in terms of race. And I was really struck on Saturday night listening to President Obama's speech at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation Awards dinner, where he was, you know, kind of speaking about his My Brother's Keeper initiative and really responding to the criticism mm-hmm. That has floated around about the fact that My Brother's Keeper is focused on boys and men of color and excludes women and girls of color, even though we exist in the same communities, the same classrooms, are, you know, challenged by the criminal justice system in similar ways. And what he said by way of kind of addressing some of that criticism was, you know, that black women and girls, you know, are either highly and unfairly scrutinized or cloaked in a kind of invisibility. when he said that, I, you know, my mind went to some of these conversations that we're having about mm-hmm. how black women show up in media. I mean, this gets to a larger point about kind of, we're talking about women, black women who are presented in media as being highly accomplished, having connections to power, running things, being, you know, the boss of various institutions. And I think what we can leave out is a conversation about the black girls and women who are actually struggling and who we don't see, you know, in our television shows and in our entertainment. And I think the absence of some of those issues or some of the, you know, the kind of invisibility of black women and girls who are struggling can lead to the kind of policy mm-hmm. that we see developed in, for example, in My Brother's Keeper, where obviously our boys and men are struggling, and so we need to be, you know, funneling resources their way and kind of lifting them up. But, you know, as many critics have asked, what about the women and girls? So I just think, you know, I love pop culture and all that, but my mind tends to go to the kind of policy implications of you know, who we see showing up in culture. And I think that this My Brother's Keeper piece and the way that women and girls have been excluded is a way to think about, you know, the ramifications of kind of, you know, how we show up in pop culture and the extent to which those of us in the community who are struggling and challenged by the education system, the criminal justice system, you know, whether they're getting the attention they deserve at a policy level.
And I think the ways in which they are pushing that agenda, I think, are important. I just want to add that with Kimberly Crenshaw and Paula Giddings from that whole initiative to get girls included, they have been able to use both Twitter, you know, social media, mm-hmm. as well as telling people, write op-eds, do videos, let's attack this on all levels to keep our voice very, very relevant. So I agree with you.
Do we have this? I'm trying to, the screen keeps going back and forth. We do have callers over there. 410-319-8888. Is it Kay on the line? Line, you're on the air. 410-319-8888. Hi, Kay, or Sunday.
Hi, how are you?
Welcome.
Thank you. Hi, I'm commenting just on the angry black woman stereotype and how it plays out into the workplace, and also how it's really important, how I love Scandal because I love the role of Olivia and how it's empowering, and I would love more roles like that and where white people can more understand black culture. And then also, I just wanted to talk about the way, like, the angry black woman stereotype, like, plays out into the workplace is sometimes, for example, I'm so nervous.
Don't be nervous. Just take a breath. You're doing fine. Take a breath. Okay. You're all right.
Thank you. Okay. So when our executives that we work for that are white have these beliefs about who we are, they play out into how they treat us. For example, I'm a line chef, and I love my job. And my executive chef asked me, you know, why do you never smile? You're always mad. You're never smiling, you know. And I had to think about this, like how I always have to keep this constant smile on my face, although I'm an upbeat person and, you know, great personality, great friendly, but I had to make a joke with him that, you know, I do muscle exercises this morning so I can smile more. and I think he may have understood that, you know, I'm not this mean person. And I've had a friend who, you know, she's a line chef as well, who, you know, just standing with her hands folded, like in cambro, you know, because we're on the line, we're standing, get tired, get comfortable with our hands folded across our chest may look like we're mm-hmm. angry, and it's perceived mm-hmm. that way. And so I wish, like, maybe, like, you know, we can get more black roles like this in media where we are portrayed, you know, powerful and also in better lights than the characters now. So the white people that aren't in direct everyday conversation with us, just passing, as you guys were saying, can have some other type of exposure or better exposure to black culture. And thank you so much. No, I really love listening to you guys.
Thank you, Sandra. Thanks for joining us. That's 410-319-8888. I think what you said on a lot of levels here is very important, Kay. I mean, it was just whether it's what she was saying about her relationship to people at work, yes. and how black women are perceived, the whole kind of why can't you smile thing, which is
right.
so prevalent.
Which
I
is
think
so prevalent.
Prevalent
it is. I think that's interesting that this caller raised quite a few issues. I mean, she's dealing with it as a line chef. I deal with it as a professor, that I'm constantly working on managing my face, because if I am not smiling, then I'm perceived as being angry. And it's a very racially charged term to call someone an angry black woman, because we don't say angry white woman.
Right.
Like, we don't, you know, add that label to someone. If I stand up in a meeting and I'm passionate about something and I'm really speaking from the heart, then later I'm asked, what made you so angry? Sure. Why were you angry when you responded? When I go in to fight on behalf of my sons, they constantly, mommy, you know, you might want to smile, because my sons, even at 13 and 11, said, well, if you look angry, then no one's going to listen to you, as if. Right. A black woman who's not smiling, who's passionate, who wants change to happen, automatically is angry, as if we operate only from our emotions, as if we are not intelligent and critical thinkers, where we can be passionate about issues without having a tie to what has been perceived to be as the negative emotion of anger. It's what I said earlier. Anger is something that only when it's applied to black women does it become something that's negative.
Well, and because we are living our lives differently, because we are living in different skin, mm-hmm. the things that are going to evoke passion from me may not be things that my white colleagues are living or experiencing. It is interesting to me when I'm talking about race with parents, black and white. Black parents are talking about something that has happened to them or happened to their children. White parents are talking about what they've seen happen to someone. And it is a different response that you will get when that is the space that you're occupying, which is why the conversations become so critically important.
And I think that, you know, women in general are seen, if they have any position of power, are always seen as domineering, as a bitch, as whatever it is, because you speak up and you have something to say, and you know that they're not taken seriously, and often I hear this from women all the time, that they'll say something in a meeting, suggest something, and all of a sudden it's not heard, and then a man says it, mm-hmm. and oh, it's like this brand new idea, mm-hmm. but it's compounded if you happen to be mm-hmm. a black woman mm-hmm. in
right.
the situation, right?
Yes.
So I think that. When I thought about it, and I want to go break the phones here, something that I didn't think about this until you actually said it, Kay, was maybe when Alessandra wrote the word not classically beautiful, mm-hmm. maybe she was actually saying she's breaking barriers
yeah.
as mm-hmm. opposed to saying something negative. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think about that until after you said it, because I was mm-hmm. you know, charged up in a whole other way of thinking about it. But that mm-hmm. may be clearly what she was trying to do there, maybe. 410-319-8888. Kay, you're on the air.
Hey, Mr. Steiner.
Good morning.
First, give the a little history lesson.
We're not too long. We don't have so much time. So
we wasn't so-called attractive in slavery, and rape was the order of the day. Okay, anytime they wanted us, they had us. So it couldn't have been a thing about attraction. The second question is uh-huh. why is it even to this day that we all have to try to do what pleases white folks? Okay, but how they perceive us, etc., etc. Why do we always have to? Why we have to make them understand? They understand. They brought us here. And they conditioned us. They understand perfectly well.
Kay, what were you about to say?
Well, I just wanted to kind of just go against that a little bit. I understand what your caller is saying. I think at the end of the day, it's not about us trying to make, as she said, quote, white people understand. I think it's trying to have a better and greater conversation across racial lines, across gender lines, across class lines, that we're getting to a place where conversation can be used as a tool to bring about change. And when she says they bought us here, as a historian, I immediately kind of raise up with that, because part of that process of they bringing us here, unquote, is that there were Africans who were trading with Europeans to sell off different African tribes and bring them over here. So even that particular history is complicated, more than just they brought us here, they conditioned us, so they just need to understand us. We are not at that place anymore. The place we are now is that we need to use conversation, the tools that we have. We need to use op-eds, use the media, use everything that we can use to get people to understand, because it's not just about the white community. It's also people within the black community. It's also the brown community that needs to have greater conversation around this issue of race.
And Danny, let me... Go ahead, Danny.
Oh, God.
No, go ahead. I was about to call on you.
And it's also not just about kind of the interpersonal conversations. It's about shifting institutions, and that does matter, right? I was so moved by what the earlier caller said about, being told to smile. It's something I've been thinking about so much lately, because that's a lesson. That is a message I've gotten since I was 5 years old. I remember going to kindergarten. No, I remember going to kindergarten and having my, and I went to a predominantly white school, and never had a non-white teacher until I went away to college, and just being constantly told to smile, smile, smile. And it was such a shock to me, because in my family, you know, it was no expectation that I was walking around with smile-inducing thoughts in my head all the time, right? But the fact that, that I wasn't smiling was obviously so threatening to this larger community. So I think, you know, and one of your guests talked about the work, the additional work of managing your faith. That's something that I can imagine a boss or, you know, not even really thinking about. In addition to all this work that I'm here doing, you have also put on me the additional burden of managing my faith all the time. And I think we have to have these conversations because we can hope and we can, you know, push for these revelations, this kind of sharing of our experiences to actually have some impact so that people who hold power within institutions mm-hmm. can begin to change.
Right. I wish we had more time. This has really been a fascinating discussion. You all have been great. We have time to get one quick caller. We do not. No, they're saying no. I'm sorry. So read in the other callers. I apologize. People called in later in the show, but that's fine. I'm glad you were listening. The show moved you and you were thinking about this. Look forward to a dialogue on our webpage and tweet me later at Mark Stein. I'd like to hear and keep this going. I want to thank our guest, Dr. You just heard Dana McLean, contributing a writer to The Nation, where she reports on gender issues. She's a fellow with the Nation Institute. Dr. Lisa Williams, Director of Equity and Cultural Proficiency at Baltimore County Schools, member of the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a project of Fusion Partnerships. Dr. Kay Whitehead, Assistant Professor of Communications and Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and African American Studies at Loyola University of Maryland. And sometime in the next 2 weeks from now, we'll have her back here.
Excellent.
Right after our
Thank
fun
you.
Drive for Notes for a Colored from a Girl to Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, a marvelous book. Thank the three of you so much for being
Thank
with us.
Thank you so much,
Thank
Mark.
You.
Anytime.
It's been a great conversation. And we're going out with Marilyn Moco. It's her birthday. She was born on this day in 1944 in Newark, New Jersey. We'll be right back. Stay with us. It's time for Sound Bites.